So hello, my name is Jay Freeman. Everyone online knows me as Sork. So one of the things I always do when I start a talk is I explain the format of the particular talk, because I tend to do random things with the formats in my talk. Today, new thing for me, I'm doing this without slides. One of the things that I've noticed is that the format of DragonCon talks generally don't have slides. They're usually panels. There's more discussion with the audience. I had slides in 2014. It's funnily enough, when I see other people come up here and pull out slides, I'm always like, seriously, they're pulling out the slides? And the material I'm talking about today also, honestly, just doesn't necessarily fit well with slides. But that also means that I've got notes and an outline here, and we'll see if I do anything horribly dumb. All right, so who am I? So I teach at the College of Creative Studies, UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara. It's a weirdly unofficial position that I've kind of hacked my way into having. I'm also now recently a local politician in Santa Barbara area. But the reason why I'm up here is that I'm the developer of Cydia, the alternative to the App Store for jailbroken iPhones. So I handle things that occur after the hack. All jailbroken phones that you likely have ever seen are running my software on it. I provide the software that allows people to modify other people's programs, distribute those modifications in an easy way. I also provide the tooling that allows people to monetize those modifications. So we kind of get then to, what is jailbreaking? What is the goal of jailbreaking? Well, a lot of people hear that I run the alternative to the App Store, and they immediately think about stuff that Apple rejects from their App Store. That's a really common like storyline. You'll hear about something get rejected from the App Store, and then the comments on the articles online will say, "Oh, I guess they're going to go to Cydia next." And Cydia is kind of gets described as the reject bin for the App Store. So I'm going to say Cydia is not the reject bin for the App Store. Cydia is about things that the App Store model would never have been able to support in the first place. Apps are a limited concept of computing. They have an icon on your screen. They are something that you can open, and now you're inside of, you close, you exit from. There are other ways of thinking about that. Now, that said, when jailbreaking first happened, and this is part of the issue, jailbreaking was about apps. So when on the original iPhone, there was no App Store. The original iPhone did not even come with a stock app as a game. And if you think about like a Nokia candy bar phone, they always had at least a copy of Snake or something like a Hangman type game. And Apple, continuing the weird tradition that Apple just doesn't get games and the gamers don't use Apple, the iPhone comes out with not a single game. And so people were jailbreaking at the time in order to install TapTap Revenge, in order to install, somebody came up with one of those table marble games where you can move your iPhone around and have the marble try to like avoid falling into the holes and get the other side of the maze. That ended up being, my understanding, half of people with an iPhone were jailbreaking at that time, because games is just such a killer thing that you want to have on your mobile device. Apple at the time was kind of talking about how web apps would be the future. And Steve Jobs is talking about how they were going to be really concentrating on Safari and the experience of web apps. And then we did this whole jailbreaking thing, and it seems like they drastically changed course. They immediately announced that there was going to be an SDK. They immediately announced that there was going to be an App Store. They announced a release date for it, which turned into a beta, which then caused another 6 months until there was an actual release date of what was going on. Now, I say that so jailbreaking ended up for a lot of users was about games, but now we can look at what is the name jailbreaking. Why is it called that? What were people actually doing with it? It was to give people file system access to the device. So if you wanted to install a game, what you really needed is the ability to write files to the applications folder. You needed to be able to copy an app onto the device. And all of the mechanisms that you had access to in order to copy things to and from the device were limited in where they could store things. They were jailed on the device. And so you needed a way to escape that jailed part of the file system, which is actually very similar, if not actually identical in some cases, to the BSD jail models. And so the jailbreaks allowed you to get full file system access to the device. Once you have full file system access to the device, you very rapidly realize that it's essentially running Mac OS X. The iPhone is running the same stack of software, same libraries. It's running a different CPU architecture, but it is a very similar software set to Mac OS X, which is based on Unix. So a lot of people get really excited Unix. And we start installing utilities onto it. And so people installed SSH servers on the iPhone. People had, you could easily get shells on the iPhone. One of the big things that I did initially is I worked on improving all of the low-level Unix utilities people had installed. Instead of a kind of a giant wad of them, I provided packages individually that could be upgraded similar to Debian. I actually literally ported Debian apt to the iPhone. I ported all of the GNU utilities instead of all of the BSD utilities. And there's an article that ended up coming out in Linux Insider, Android Smandroid, Linux on the iPhone, which is totally a misunderstanding of what was going on. But that's okay, because there's a one point that they made, which is kind of good. Quote from Brian J. Fox. I'm just telling you it's a quote leading into this, if it says it afterwards. This is from the article. My iPhone has 16 gigabytes of disk space, 128 megabytes of RAM, a 600 plus megahertz processor, and a much better display than my original computer. And it has Darwin open source ported to it. So it's essentially a Unix-like operating system, which led guys like Jay and myself to use the phone as if it were a Unix workstation and write applications in a familiar Unix-based environment. Brian J. Fox, founder and technology partner at the Cori Group, told Linux Insider. Fox should know, he was the first employee at the Free Software Foundation, and while there he wrote Bash, a Unix shell, for the GNU project back in 1987, which has become the de facto shell on most Linux systems, as well as on Mac OS X. He also developed Wells Fargo's online banking system and has been chief technology officer at various startups. So having all of these like standard Unix utilities on the device, being able to go on the device and use rsync on the full file system, this is now turning the device into a computer for a lot of people. And for a good fraction of the initial users, that was what was really awesome about jailbreaking. But then somebody came up with, I believe specifically it was Slava Korpensky from the Russian iPhone Development Group, same person who built Application Enhancer for Mac OS X, which is something you may or may not remember, or if you used it, you may or may not have been around at the time and or paying attention to computing. But Application Enhancer was a tool for Mac OS X that allowed you to modify other applications. It allowed you to modify the shell of the system. It allowed you to add themes. He was bringing Mobile Enhancer to the device, which is like Application Enhancer. And he and the people who had been working on some of the initial installer tools had theming engines that were allowed you to change all the icons, all of the graphics. This ended up being something that now an entire new group of people got excited about. Going and changing all of the, if you want your favorite sports team, you just want to see that constantly. You want every single icon on your system to be themed by that, related to that sports team. You could do that. Now, you could theme everything, but I'm going to say that one of the most important things you could theme was wallpaper. So on the original iPhone, the background was black. And the background was black for the following 3 or 4 years. It wasn't until iOS 4 that you could actually have a wallpaper. And I always used to kind of joke that the day that Steve Jobs allows people to have wallpapers on their phone is the day that I lose half my user base. Now that comment about losing good portions of your user base when Apple finally introduces something, that happens over time, because there are things that they're killer applications that people are, and when I say applications, not apps, but killer use cases of jailbreaking that Apple would slowly end up integrating. One of the very first things is when the iPhone first came out, there was no good way to take data from one application, copy and paste it, and use it in another application. There was no copy and paste functionality. And so we had copy and paste. And we had actually multiple competing implementations of copy and paste with different user interfaces that were available on jailbroken devices. Copy and paste ended up getting integrated into iOS, might have been iOS or iOS 2, but it was certainly iOS 3 had copy and paste. Multitasking, the ability to, when the original iPhone, when you had an application open and you closed it, it would shut that app down. It would save what it was doing so that it could recover where it was, but when you opened another app, it would kind of load that app, and it would keep certain kinds of applications that worked great for, other apps that did not work very well for, Apple's apps that generally worked very well for, but all the third-party apps in the App Store tended to work very poorly for. People would not save all the state that really made sense. So you'd end up opening the app, and you'd kind of be stuck in some different location in the app than you were earlier. So we had features on jailbroken devices where you could make it so that apps didn't get shut down when you switched away from them. We actually added multitasking, got added in iOS 4. Although a limited version of it, it was added in iOS 4. Modern iOS, you've got the control center where you pull up from the bottom and you've got a bunch of like lower level things. You can quickly change the volume, quickly change the screen brightness. Original iOS did not have that. That was something that Big Boss had really popularized with SB settings. He had it come from the top initially, but that ended up being where Notification Center ended up coming. But SB Settings was really, really popular, and actually had an entire plugin model where people could build new settings in order to go into that little panel. Control Center gets integrated. People have been improving the notifications mechanism on iOS, because notifications on iOS are just really brutal, honestly. Even today. Home screens. On Android, you have the ability, in one of the limited interaction changes you can have there, so you can change the home screen out so that you can have a different way of browsing your apps. That's one of the most popular things people will do, is they on jailbroken iPhones, as far as now software modifications, to change out the home screen. You can have alternate keyboards. Now, Apple finally integrated alternate keyboards, but alternate keyboards were something that were really popular, especially in China for doing Chinese input. They were really popular. Some of them were very unpopular. It's a fun one. Somebody added Morse code, two-panel, very, very fast and effective Morse code. Effectively, no one used that. But that's also something, is that jailbreaking is these things that were killer use cases for everybody. But jailbreaking has also been about the things that 100 people in the world would ever want, and for everyone else, it might even be a bad idea to have. By allowing you to have the flexibility to do what you want to do to your device, and if there's a developer out there who has that same passion that you do, well, maybe you actually succeed in getting Morse code keyboard on your phone. Some people is more of a necessity. There's one person in the jailbreak community, Justin Wack, who actually comes and speaks at our JailbreakCon conference every year. Justin Wack is blind, and he jailbreaks his iPhone in order to improve the screen reading functionality. He actually considers it essentially essential to his life to have a jailbroken iPhone, because he needs the ability to make these certain modifications, sometimes to third-party apps that he really needs access to that didn't spend the time to support him correctly. Sometimes it's to Apple's apps. So Apple's generally very good, but sometimes there are a few things where he feels that he's able to improve. And so he himself is a developer, and he actually has been working on some of these modifications himself. Another example is Flux, the color changing on the phone. This is a fun example because it's a very recent one. So Flux is something that was released for desktop Macs that would make it so that during the night, the screen would be tinted red. And the goal there is that blue light, some research indicates, resets your circadian rhythms and keeps you awake and kind of messes with you if you're constantly staring at blue light. And so if you decrease the amount of blue on your screen, you get better sleep and your life just becomes generally better. I love Flux. I've got Flux on my phone here. Although I'm running an old version of the firmware, you now don't need to do that as of iOS 9.3. There was a mechanism that Apple's released that I'll talk about a little bit later that ended up allowing people to install applications, including applications like Flux, to their phone that had extended abilities without jailbreaking. And Flux was one of the ones that was able to be doing this with. And within one day of releasing Flux for non-jailbroken phones, the people who work on Flux got 100,000 downloads and a letter from Apple saying, stop that. Then suddenly a month later, Apple announces that the feature of Flux has been integrated into the operating system. So jailbreaking itself, how have we done it over the years? So when the very first jailbreak that was released was a forum post by Planet Being, one of the people who has been working on jailbreaking ever since the beginning. And I point that out because Planet Being continued working on jailbreaking until very, very recently. He's been involved in this community forever. Planet Being's jailbreak is famous for being the 74-step jailbreak. Now, people say this because it's so complicated, it's so ludicrous, but he was really trying to make it so that anyone could follow his 74 steps. And so there's a step of click this menu, and then click this submenu, and then drag this from here to here. Type this one thing and hit enter. And so the 74 steps go by very quickly. I mean, if you were writing a recipe and you were trying to summarize the recipe for somebody, you could have now take one spoonful of this and put it over into here, and then take one slice of bread and put it here. Or you could say, take some bread and put these items between it. You'd probably end up having 10 steps. This 74-step jailbreak used the protocol that iTunes used over USB in order to control the device, in order to modify the file system, and by downloading the entire file system over USB, modifying and then putting the entire file system back. It was kind of weird and sketchy a little bit, but it worked, and it gave people access to the device. Apple very quickly realized that the iTunes protocol was way too powerful and started locking that down. So the iPhone, when it boots up, there's a block of code called the bootloader. The bootloader is what's in charge of finding the operating system of the device and loading it in and setting up everything on the phone. There's this concept that we have in security called a chain of trust. So if I want to trust somebody that I don't know, but I trust somebody who trusts somebody that trusts that person, and I have a way of actually verifying that each of those layers of trust exist. Now, of course, in real world, trust is weirdly sketchy sometimes, but if in a more perfect mechanism of trust, you should be able to now trust through that chain. There was a mistake in the chain of trust on this device. So the bootloader is in charge of trusting the operating system. And so if the operating system works, if the operating system is running on the phone, it's because the bootloader trusted it. What trusted the bootloader? Well, the bootloader is trusted because the only things that can write data to the file system are things that Apple has developed that Apple trusts. But what can write data to the file system? Well, it's not just Apple's restore processes, Apple's upgrade mechanisms. It turns out that there was a normal driver, like an operating system driver, that was installed with the operating system called Apple Image 2 NOR Write. And so NOR just happens to be the kind of memory that this has. So it's just a way of writing data to the flash memory on the device. And if you had access at the operating system level, you now had the ability to write anything you wanted to that to the flash, and nothing verified that. That was the beginning of the chain of trust. And getting there, now getting access to that driver can be difficult because that driver is only supposed to be accessed by software running on the phone that should have access to that driver. But now what's running on the phone once the phone is booting up? Everything's running on the phone. The web browser is running on the phone. We probably often hear about security exploits in web browsers. Well, there are security exploits in mobile web browsers. And so there was an exploit in the TIFF image file parser, one of the most horrendous file formats from a security perspective that mankind has ever come up with, sadly. The same exploit, I believe, that was used to jailbreak the PlayStation Portable ended up getting used then in order to take control of Safari on the phone. Now, once you've taken control of Safari, Safari was running as root. It was running as the administrator. It was running as the most powerful user on the system. It had access to Apple Image 2 NOR Write. You then use that in order to change the bootloader, such that the bootloader no longer checks the trust of the operating system. And now you can change the operating system on the device, such that you can then boot the system up, and you've totally taken control of the device. The device is now yours. Now, that's great. This is something that Apple, of course, is going to fix in the web browser, and then Apple removed Apple Image 2 NOR Write, and Apple finally goes around and adds trust verification to the bootloader. So the bootloader now, when the system starts up, there is another block of code that you can't change on the phone, and that block of code that you can't change on the phone has cryptographic signatures from Apple, and it verifies that the bootloader is good, and so that way they can still upgrade the giant bootloader. But then the bootloader verifies that the operating system is good, and then the operating system verifies that all of the apps are good. Well, it turns out that they made a mistake in the mechanism that was used to do the cryptographic verification. You generally should have very simple cryptographic verification. They had a really complicated way of checking these certificates, and the parser for the certificate that signed everything had a bug in it, and people were able to come up with an exploit for the certificate parser. And now they could put anything on the device that was signed incorrectly. It had a broken certificate that broke the checker and allowed install things to the device. Now, there's a slight difference there. So this bug actually lets you run anything you want, but every single time you start the phone, you had to plug in over USB in order to put it there again. Because if you didn't do that, the original bootloader from Apple was still there, and the original image, and so there ended up being this bug, which was the 24K Pwn, and somebody highly technical in my extended audience is probably going to complain about it. Watch me have gotten one of these two things in backwards. But so 24K Pwn then was something that allowed you to have a corrupted image on the device. And that corrupted image on the device then was able to break the certificate parsing as it every single time that it started. And so this allowed you to now both run something arbitrarily and have it continue running on the device. Well, Apple keeps fixing these bugs. Apple really doesn't want these bootloader bugs. And so Apple actually cared so much that for the Apple 3GS, halfway through the production cycle, they stopped the presses. and they fixed this. They fixed the 24K Pwn, and then they started pushing out new 3GSs. And so we actually have like a model number break on the serial number break on the 3GS, where if you have a serial number before this version, then you have the really good jailbreaks, and if you don't, then you've got bad ones. All right, so up until this point, I've been talking about these bugs that are in the bootloader. I've been talking about the ability to essentially take control of the hardware. We have ways of just taking control of an early iPhone 3GS forever, because we've understood issues in the trust chain that allowed us to, or bugs in the certificate verification that allowed us to put arbitrary operating systems there. We ran out of those bugs around iOS 3. Now, we found more later, but when iOS 3 and the iPad came out, Comex, who was one of the major jailbreakers, now is one of the major jailbreakers. At the time, was this up and coming 17-year-old kid, who sat around and figured out how to jailbreak that iPad, and he did it by, instead of attacking everything that occurs, that verifies the operating system, that verifies the kernel, all those things, he started at the end. He started back down at, well, what's running on the phone? We've got the backup and restore daemon. We've got the web browser. And he started attacking those things. He found bugs in the backup and restore mechanism that allowed him to momentarily get execution on the device. He found then bugs in the kernel that allowed him to take control of the operating system. And he figured out ways of making it so that every time the phone booted, the phone would boot the normal, correct operating system. It would be verified by Apple all the way through to it starts running like code that regular users have put on the phone. And then he would use these bugs that he found in order to take control and reclaim the device as it finishes booting. Now, the thing that's really frustrating about these kinds of bugs is that, unlike the bootloader bugs where Apple can't really fix it because there was nothing on the phone that verified trust, well, then there was something that verified the trust, but it was wrong. Well, now it's just software. So Apple would release a point release for the firmware, and all of Comex's bugs would get fixed. Comex was the kind of developer who just keep finding bugs. He then came out with an exploit for the web browser again. This one was a bug in the TrueType font render. And so he was able to build PDF files that took control of the web browser, and then he found bugs in the frame buffer, the graphics system of the device, in order to gain control of the kernel again. He spent so long working on the next version of this that while he was working on it, Apple fixed one of his bugs. And we were like, well, Comex, that's because you're just a perfectionist. You really should be releasing these things more quickly. And hours later, he comes back and says, I found another bug. I'm like, oh. He's just so good at finding these bugs. But also, you might ask, well, why was that? Well, part of it is, I mean, Comex is amazing at this. Part of it, though, is that we had never really spent much time looking for bugs in any of those areas. 5 years of this device had now existed, and we had never really paid attention, or I guess 4 years of this device had existed. We never really paid attention to any of these user land things in order to find bugs in them, because we could just find bugs in the hardware itself. Now, thankfully, somebody then found, and so it was George Hotz, who did some of the original work on doing unlocks on the phone, then later went on and did jailbreaks for the PlayStation 3. GeoHot ended up finding another bootloader bug, and which is called Lime Rain. It was a bug in the USB control mechanism. You actually, the way that it did the USB protocol itself, the way that it handled USB was flawed, and so he found a bug in that. And so we once again took control of the device momentarily until Apple fixed that with the iPhone 4S. Now, Lime Rain is another example of a bug from earlier. Now I'm going to actually explain this a little bit more, where we have the ability as the phone boots to change what it runs, but we don't have the ability when you reboot it to still have control. Because Lime Rain was something that affected USB. It didn't affect the verification, the trust verification. So what you're able to do is you're able to get to a point where everything is trusted that now is trying to use USB wrong, then break that code, take control of it at that point, and everything after that point you now have control over. But everything up until that point is still original, trustable mechanisms. And so we end up having something that we sometimes would call a tethered jailbreak. Tethered jailbreaks suck. So an untethered jailbreak is one where every time I use my phone and I reboot it, it still works. Because I'm out somewhere, I run out of battery. I'm out somewhere and I just, something weird goes on with my phone and I need to reboot it. A tethered jailbreak is one where when I reboot it, it goes back into the original trust mechanism, and it starts verifying the trust. And layer one verifies layer two, and layer three is wrong because you jailbroke it and modified stuff, and now the phone doesn't work. And so you're left with this like this phone that just boots up to an error screen, and you can't do anything to it until you plug it back into a computer and use USB in order to take control of the device over again. Now, we tried to make that better. We ended up coming up with solutions we called semi-tether, where we modified as little as possible on the file system as we could, such that if the device booted back up, it would trust everything, and you'd get something that sort of looked like your phone, but it wouldn't have all of your fun modifications. It would just have the original stock operating system parts. You couldn't run any of the jailbreak features that you installed. You could only use the original stuff from Apple. And if you happened to modify anything, you would break it, and you'd end up now having a tethered jailbreak. All right, so now we're moving into like iOS 5. And iOS 5, we start seeing that we've got the iPhone 4S. We just don't have any of these bootloader jailbreaks anymore. And so now we start doing bug to bug, version to version. And the Planet Bing and the iPhone dev team, very poorly named. I don't like that name. Trademark issues, if nothing else. Planet Bing and the iPhone dev team, which later renamed themselves to Evaders. Thank you for renaming yourself. Not quite renamed yourself, but the most of the people from the iPhone dev team that were actually doing work ended up constructing the group Evaders, and so it was effectively a rename. Evaders ended up working on jailbreaks that would take advantage of the dynamic loader. They would take advantage of the initialization daemon. All these things that would start when the system very first starts running, they would take control of those things in order to get control of the system, and Apple would fix it. And then they would do it again, and Apple would fix it. And the best part about this weird cat and mouse game, I mean, best, most humorous to me, best, worst to Apple, is that Apple kept fixing the bug wrong. Like, you look at these slides from some of the later jailbreak teams like Pengu, and they're just explaining that, okay, so there was this bug, and here's what we did to exploit it, and then here's what Apple did to fix it. Does anyone see the issue? Yeah, Apple didn't fix it. And so here's what we did to break it again, and then did Apple try to fix it? Yes. Did Apple really fix it? No. Here's what we did. There's this great slide Pengu presented last year at one of the conferences they presented, where it's just like, does Apple even understand this bug? And so Apple finally will fix these things after like 3 or 4 attempts. And so then they'll move on and they'll have like another like set of breaks. But there isn't that much code when the device starts up, to be honest. I mean, there's just not that much opportunity to attack. And so the attack surface, as long as Apple just doesn't keep adding features and adding functionality, gets smaller and smaller. It takes longer and longer to find these attacks. It becomes more and more difficult to have jailbreaks, and in many ways, the jailbreaks become worse and worse. We end up seeing these tethered jailbreaks, these semi-tethered jailbreaks. The most recent jailbreak from Pengu for iOS 9.2.9.3 is brutal from a user perspective. It's brutal. So they have a bug in the frame buffer again. It's in the graphics system. It's in the it's something that any application running on the phone has access to, including applications you download from the App Store. So something that you download that's designed to be very safe and secure and contained, even that has access to the feature of the operating system that's broken that has that bug. And because of that, they were able to install a normal app to the phone that then you clicked and ran and would take control of the phone and allow you to do all of our crazy stuff. Now, that normal app we would install now using free developer accounts, and so I released a tool called CD Impactor that allowed you to install things easily using the free developer account mechanism, and that would jailbreak the phone. But here's the problem is that it's something you kind of have to run. It's something that it expires after a period of time, and so it's not even really safe to try to even trick it into running every time the device boots up. It required a little bit of interaction because you had to like use the app and then exit the app to the lock screen to get a notification to appear because they needed this notification in order to break everything. It required some steps, and every time you rebooted the device, it was kind of like a tethered jailbreak. You would reboot it, and now the device's trust chain would verify all the way to the point he had to get all the way to normal app execution, which is farther than we normally ever have to let the device set up. So you're much more likely to break it by changing things. You're much more likely to install something that has some kind of silly modification to a preferences file, and now the device crashes a little bit, and you can't get far enough to run this app again to jailbreak the phone. It's weird because it gives you it looks like it has some of the benefits of an untethered jailbreak. It allows you to walk around with the phone, and if you reboot it, you just click on the app and jailbreak it, and you're like, that's awesome. But it actually is worse in many ways than a tethered jailbreak, because if you can't get to that point, the device is just broken. Like with the tethered jailbreak, if you degraded it, like with the semi-tethered or these tethered jailbreaks, if you got it to the point where the device doesn't boot and you have to plug it in over USB to fix it, well, at least you can plug it in over USB to fix it. With the semi-untethered jailbreak, which is what many of us have been calling this new jailbreak, you can either boot the phone or you're screwed. And when you're screwed, you have to format the device. You have to format the device to the current version of the firmware that Apple allows you to install, and that current version of the firmware won't be jailbreakable. You've lost all the data on your phone. It's just this like worst case horrible scenario. It's gotten to the point where I honestly like felt bad and did not recommend. Like I didn't go out and tell everyone, oh, this jailbreak is really awesome. You should do it when I meet people in person. I'm to the point with the semi-untethered jailbreak. I just can't in good faith tell people jailbreaking is something fun for you to do. Jailbreaking is now something that if you really need it, maybe you should try it. Somebody asked a question, I'm actually running iOS 8.4 on my actually physically jailbroken iPhone 6. I've been meaning to upgrade to iOS 9.0.2. I've got another device which I've been using. Actually, it's that camera, which is running iOS 9.0.2. It's an iPhone 6S. I'm meaning to move my data to there. I'm probably not going to. I've got a device running iOS 9.3 jailbroken. I don't think I'm going to upgrade to that. She's running 9.0.2. Ask a question about jailbreaking 10. The people who work on jailbreaks typically don't work on much on jailbreaks for beta versions of the firmware, certainly not public release jailbreaks for the beta versions of the firmware, because Apple will just fix it in the beta and like a few thousand users will end up benefiting from it. This changed a little bit because now the betas are public. Like now anyone can install later betas. You don't have to have a developer account, but still it's not really worth it from the jailbreak team's perspective. I can also tell you that the reason why the iOS 9.3 jailbreak came out is because Pangu had that kernel bug, the IO Mobile frame buffer, the frame buffer bug that they could use from an app. Apple happened to find it and happened to fix it in iOS 10 beta 2 or beta 3. And so they were now sitting on this bug that they had nothing else they could really do with. They didn't have the other bugs they needed to put together a full jailbreak stack with a nice untether. And so they just put together what they had into this weird semi-untethered jailbreak. They were expecting to also have to release a 74-step guide with it too. They didn't know that I had built a tool that would make it really easy for users on Windows to install apps using their free developer account. I've just been kind of sitting on that since last August, waiting for a need for it in the community. And suddenly, it's like I realize, oh wow, this is it. So we've seen Apple's been adding mitigations over the years. I mean, Apple started adding firmware verification, the bootloader. Apple, originally the web browser was running as the administrator, and so they made it so that everything was running as two user accounts, where there was actually a mobile account. They added code signing to verify that the code that was running in user land was actually verified by the kernel, adding it to the chain of trust. They added sandboxes and seat belts to keep you from exiting the application that you're inside of and getting access to things you shouldn't. Recently, one of the things Pangu keeps running into, they talk about is Team ID validation. The applications can normally load libraries of code that other people have written. No. You can load code that Apple has written, or you can load code that you have written. But now applications can, like an Apple app, actually will notice the difference between code that Apple's written and Apple and code that Apple's not written, and it will not load a library signed by a different developer. So even if you've kind of defeated code sign, even if you've done the even if you have the ability to get your code running on a device in various ways, you now can't get Apple's applications to load your libraries. And the most recent thing, which has been really, really painful, is kernel patch protection. So now one of the things we would do is, in order to defeat that final chain of trust, the part where the kernel is verifying all the code that gets run, we modify the kernel so that it doesn't do those things anymore. And now the Apple keeps checking the kernel to see if it's changed. And if it changes, they shut the phone down. Now, Pangu tells me that it's really, really lax. I mean, it's lazy. So it just waits until the phone will get around to like not be very busy. Sometimes they've seen it wait hours before it will notice that the device has been modified in some weird way. And so sometimes people have talked about, well, we could have a really weird, like a jailbreak that works for 2 hours. And then your phone reboots. And you know, the first few tries, you know, it's random. So like the first few tries, it actually just notices immediately. And then you get it good. And it's just like, oh, this is getting silly. Yeah. All right, so some legal issues. What kind of makes this difficult? So people talk, like people ask these questions, like, is jailbreaking legal? Well, so the only thing that really ever comes up is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a law that is actually an implementation of a treaty. And I bring this up because if you ever really hate on Congress for implementing the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, please go hate on our executive branch for signing a treaty that demands that Congress implements this law. The treaty essentially states that this is a quote, contracting parties shall provide adequate legal protections and effective legal remedies against the circumvention of effective technological measures that are used by authors in connection with the exercise of their rights under this treaty or the Berne Convention, and that restrict acts in respect to their works which are not authorized or permitted by law. So the United States, by signing this treaty, has stated that it will provide laws that do these things that we don't like in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So what are these laws? The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it makes it illegal to circumvent effective technological measures that are specifically used by authors in connection with this, with their rights under this act. So if you have an electronic lock that is designed to protect something from being copied and that you're not supposed to be able to copy under copyright law, I am making certain that you don't do that by putting an electronic lock on it. That electronic lock, I'm not allowed to circumvent it. Now, this is weird, because when I say I'm not allowed to, you're not allowed to also. Everyone's not allowed to. So if you have a phone, it's almost mad like when it, from the perspective of like me being the person developing Cydia doesn't even circumvent anything. From the perspective of Pengu doing it, well, Pengu does it, but, well, did Pengu run it? Well, sure they did, but you don't. The issue actually is that you're not allowed to run their tool. So it's a restriction on users from being able to do this thing with their devices, and it also restricts Pengu, but there's an interesting like split there, because you as users can get exemptions, and the reason why this is important is that you as users are supposed to have fair use rights under copyright law. You're allowed to take 30 seconds of a movie and do film critique on it. You're allowed to take a few pages from a book, and as an educator in a college class, I can pass it out and talk about that material. I can't use it to replace part of my lecture, but I can talk about we can discuss the context of that literature. These things that are supposed to be accepted under fair use, or actually a parody is another example. These things are supposed to be accepted. Suddenly, in a world with Digital Millennium Copyright Act, where DVDs are encrypted and you're not allowed to copy them because you're not allowed to circumvent the encryption mechanism, you can't have fair use. And so this was noticed by Congress, and Congress was like, all right, we're going to add a mechanism by which you can tell us that you got burned by this law, and we'll let you exempt yourself from this law. And every 3 years, there is a rulemaking, the triennial rulemaking, where everyone has to go and they have to re-argue from scratch. It actually is required to be a de novo proceeding. Congress is not allowed to simply the Library of Congress, which is in charge of this, is not allowed to simply say, well, 3 years ago you got this exemption, 3 years before that you got this exemption, clearly you should continue to get this exemption. Every single time they have to start over. For things like an exemption on motion pictures, as defined by 17 U.S.C. 101, very specific, on DVDs that are lawfully made and acquired, or that are lawfully made and acquired via online distribution services, where circumvention is undertaken solely in order to make use of short portions of the motion pictures for the purpose of criticism or comment in the following instances: 1, in non-commercial videos; 2, in documentary films; 3, in non-fiction multimedia ebooks offering film analysis; 4, for educational purposes in film studios or other courses requiring close analysis of film and media excerpts by college and university faculty, college and university students, and kindergarten through 12th grade educators. Very specific. It talks about the specific thing that you're allowed to circumvent. It talks about the specific technologies that are involved. There's actually part of this that I didn't bother reading through. Talks about the specific mechanism of the thing that you're circumventing and the specific ways in which you're allowed to use that circumvention. Literary works distributed electronically that are protected by technological measures which either prevent the enabling of read-aloud functionality or interfere with screen readers or other applications and assistive technologies. Yes, we actually require blind people to come back every 3 years to the Library of Congress in order to ask that they get to read books. This sucks. So, in 2009, the Electronic Frontier Foundation asked for an exemption for jailbreaking. They essentially asked for a exemption on jailbreaking the iPhone, to be honest, the way that it was worded. And actually, Apple pointed this out. And thankfully, thankfully that that uh, that argument, the Congress noticed that it was sufficiently general that it would apply to other devices, and so it wasn't such a big deal that it was like kind of about the iPhone. But we did end up getting an exemption that was only about phones. Computer programs that enable wireless telephone handsets to execute software applications where circumvention is accomplished for the sole purpose of enabling interoperability of such applications when they have been lawfully obtained with computer programs on the telephone handset. Now, that's great, but it's just phones. If that time, we were already jailbreaking the iPod Touch. I actually went to somebody at the EFF and was kind of like pointing out that, you know, you didn't, it was a really narrow exemption. I mean, he immediately just like cuts me off and is like, yeah, well, the iPad wasn't out when we did this. I'm like, not the iPad, the iPod Touch. I always like to point out the iPod Touch because I feel like it became the device that kids were given. It was not a phone, so it does not feel threatening that you're giving your child the ability to end up having a phone that they can call all sorts of random people with. I mean, that's something a lot of parents care about. It was really cheap. It was something that, in weird ways, was effectively subsidized in ways the phone wasn't, with relation to iTunes. And it, without having all the antennas and everything, it was just cheaper to make. Apple was giving them away for a long time. You'd buy a new computer and you'd get an iPod Touch with it. And so a lot of kids ended up inheriting iPod Touches from their parents, and the iPod Touch was this great, was this like great device that was actually a real computer that you've given them. It's just so much better than like TI calculator that I learned to program on. There's this thing called Kidfinity scores, where this marketing group that tries to figure out how well brands are doing among children. The iPad has a Kidfinity score of 898 and was their number one scoring brand. Hershey's candy scored slightly lower at 894. Oreo cookies, 885. M&M's, 883. Doritos and Cheetos continues there. Xbox shows up at number 10. The iPad was, 12-year-old boy was quoted, was like literally the quote said from 12-year-old boy. I love my iPad. I can do whatever I want with it. I can play lots of games and watch videos. These devices are things we give children to now, and this is what children are learning to do, use with their computer. They're learning to do software on. And it's not just the iPhone, by the way. So the HP 7 Plus Android tablet for $99 is like, this is like the Walmart HP 7 last year are good tablets for kids. These cheap tablets, the Android tablets, are also often locked down. So in 2012, we tried for tablets, and we failed. The registrar determined that the statutory factors weighed in favor of a renewed exemption for smartphones, as nothing in the record suggested that the market for mobile phones had been negatively impacted by the designation of such a class, and in fact, such a class might make smartphones more attractive to consumers. While joint creators raised concerns about pirated applications that are able to run on jailbroken devices, the record did not demonstrate any significant relationship between jailbreaking and piracy. On the other hand, the register concluded that the record did not support an extension of an exemption to tablet devices. The register finds significant merit to the opposition's concerns that this aspect of the proposed class was broad and ill-defined, as a wide range of devices might be considered tablets, notwithstanding significant distinctions among them in terms of the way they operate, their intended purposes, and the nature of the applications they can accommodate. For example, an e-book reading device might be considered a tablet, as might a handheld video game device or a laptop computer. I was there during the public hearings, and I remember when Marsha Hoffman from the EFF started talking about tablets, and somebody from the Library of Congress panel held up an e-reader, and it's just like, are you telling me that this e-reader might fall under your class? Because if so, I just can't support this exemption. Because from their perspective, the e-reader is a very particular device that has a very singular use case, and well, what are you going to do with a jailbroken e-reader? So we tried again in 2015. And in this case, the idea was to try to get mobile all-purpose computing devices. And the EFF spent a lot of time thinking about it, and they came up with a definition that worked. We got it. And it was a really weirdly defined definition. It has to run a mobile operating system. It has to have a CPU that was designed for mobile purposes. It has to be and you start like picking these apart, and it starts being kind of weirder and weirder as a computer person. You're trying to like come up with these differences between these devices. But politically, they loved these differences, and they gave us that difference, and they still didn't give us e-readers. So the person there was the EFF didn't even bother, by the way. Somebody did file for e-readers. Pangasa, however, fails to submit further written comments or evidentiary material in support of the petition and did not participate in the public hearings. The written comments that were received in connection with this class were abbreviated and did not offer specific factual information or legal argument in support of the exemption. At the public hearing, proponent Jay Freeman briefly mentioned that people have jailbroken ebook readers to install screensavers or achieve other functionality, but no further evidence was presented in relation to this class. There were no opposition comments filed. They just kind of thrown in there. Well, no one was opposed. Although as part of this discussion of jailbreaking exemptions for smartphones and other all-purpose mobile computing devices, NTIA expressed support for jailbreaking exemptions for dedicated ebook readers, NTIA did not point to anything specific in the record to support the requested exemption. In light of the insufficient or factual evidence or legal support of the proposed exemption, the Register declined to recommend it. I found this really frustrating because, I mean, I was actually, so in the 2015, I was on the hearing panel, Curly, and I was kind of pointing out that for mobile all-purpose computing devices, it's really difficult to really define any difference between them. I held up an iPad, and I'm like, I mean, if you look at these devices from my perspective, they're all very similar. I mean, this iPad is just a very large glass rectangle made by Apple, and this slightly smaller is just this is another slightly smaller glass rectangle made by Apple. And I stopped listing what they were, and this is just another slightly smaller glass rectangle made by Apple. And I happened to held up an iPhone 6 Plus, and then an iPhone 6, and I'm just going through it. I'm just like going through these slightly smaller glass rectangle, and I get all the way down to like an iPod Touch, and then I point out, so some of these are phones, and I have exemptions on them, and some of them aren't. Okay, well, how do you even define a phone? All right. So how many of these have phone numbers? Well, it might surprise you to find out that this iPad has a phone number because that's how Verizon gives me data plans, much to my frustration when I call them for tech support and they ask me what my phone number is. And I don't know. We ask a new question these days, though. Given my phone number, which of these devices will ring if you send me if you call me or send me a text message? Well, thanks to FaceTime Audio thanks to iMessage and on Android, thanks to Hangouts, all of them. We kind of, you'll just like slip back and forth between all of them. My phone will receive the text message and make certain that my iPad also gets it. Like you actually, there's like very little difference in the functionality of these devices even. They actually liked this argument. They were all talking about it afterwards and everything, but it didn't help with e-readers. I couldn't get a... I made a mistake in my argument that EFF person who was there kind of noticed and then went along with, where I was arguing that well, clearly because we're going to get e-readers, you should give us mobile computing too. I mean, no one even argued against e-readers, and e-readers seems obvious and all of this stuff, and the people on the panel were like, well, I don't think that was obvious. Well, but he's making such a strong point. and I looked over at Mitch Stoltz, who was there from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm like, there was no opposition, correct? And Mitch looks at me and, correct, absolutely no one filed an opposition against e-readers. but we did not get e-readers. So I was questioned about arguing about data connectivity on the Kindle, and so we're bringing it up. So like some of the Kindles now are essentially just full Android devices. That actually was helping the data connectivity on the. The people on the panel don't really like a web page that sort of works as a web because it has like some web functionality. It's really difficult to somebody who's explained these things because from their belief. From their belief, a iPod Touch and an iPhone are very different devices, right? Like it took us a long time to get to a point where we could even define that class such that they were agreed with us on that. Trying to get a device that sort of has some web functionality. What they really like seeing is in the field usage of these devices in weird ways. Now, if they need to see in the field usage of these devices in weird ways, but until we have an exemption, it's technically illegal for you to use the device in that way. I'm just. It's the entire mechanism is broken, and so thankfully the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been working with some people in Congress, and we're trying to get some actual change. And it looks like we might get some actual change coming up soon, where bills that will make it so that every 3 years, all the previous exemptions are just grandfathered in unless there is a substantive argument that they should not be. And so I'm super excited about this, but it's something that we still don't have. And it's something that is still very painful then every time you're working on this, that I know in another 3 years, if we don't maintain this ecosystem well, people are going to argue that, well, you know, clearly it's not important anymore because Apple added all that functionality you guys were doing, and now what do you got, a screensaver? Well, that wasn't good enough for the Kindle. That's not good enough for your iPhone anymore. And so final thing I'm going to talk about here is some of the one of the big things that always was an easy kind of layup in these arguments, which I'm very concerned for going in 3 years from now, is the restrictive policies of the App Store itself. You go all the way back to the beginning of my talk when I say that Cydia is not the reject bin for the App Store. But the reject bin for the App Store is a very simple argument that you can make to people on the Library of Congress panel. I spend a bunch of time arguing with them about software modification and the Game Genie, and which actually had great legal precedence. I brought up the Game Genie, and people on the panel started like complaining at me about the legality of some of these things. And I hear sighs from behind me, and I realized that the EFF lawyer behind me, and I'm like, did I just lose this whole thing? It turns out that he was actually sighing. The people on the panel didn't know that Game Genie won that case. And so we were able to actually kind of, that ended up working out well, but the problem is that it's a very abstract thing to try to explain what the benefit is. The reject bin for the App Store was always a simple benefit. And when Apple announced Swift, they very rapidly realized that they wanted a new young generation of people to grow up using this programming language. People needed to be able to actually deploy code with it. And that they didn't have the $99 developer accounts. And so the Swift team, it's my understanding, was the Swift team managed to get the free developer account program that allows you to install temporarily on your phone applications that you make. Now, temporarily, it was like 30 days. 30 days isn't that bad. You can install a bunch of them. They added a limit that you could only construct 10 new app IDs per week. That's not bad. 10 per week? I mean, okay. Then they added a limit. They made it so you could only install the app on your phone for 7 days. It's getting worse. Why is this happening? Well, it's because people realize, well, if you can install anything on your phone, well, you could actually use this. You could use this to bootstrap piracy. You don't need to have jailbroken phones. You could use this in order to install Flux on your phone, without get 100,000 people to sideload Flux onto their phone within a day of release without Apple having control over what happened. And Apple was just so angry at all this. They keep limiting it. The most recent limitation on iOS 10 betas, you are only allowed to have 3 applications installed on your phone at a time that whose pedigree can be traced back to a free developer account. Now, I've released a tool, Cydia Impact, that a lot of people are using. Actually, it was funny. I released it for the jailbreak, and immediately people started sending me bug reports and support requests because they're using it to hack Pokemon Go. I actually got more requests for their Pokemon Go hacking activities than I got for jailbreaking, and it was also frustrating because I wasn't really able to support them very well because the part of their mechanism is that they are having to decrypt a copy of Pokemon Go and then redistribute the decrypted copy, which means that they are actually doing active copyright infringement, which is something that I can't help with and I can't be involved with. But it meant that I can help you with usage of my tool, but I can't make anything easier for you. If my tool gives you an error message, I'll help you with that. But I can't work with you on your Pokemon Go issues. But I'm working on that. So that's actually one of my big goals currently is to try to figure out how I can, without having any direct copyright infringement copying issues, support that kind of use case. And by the way, there are a lot of alternative things that exist in the ecosystem you can try to buy into. Literally, you can pay subscription fees to that'll try to help you with these things. They all have this copyright infringement problem. You can't legally defend any of them. I'm working on getting this so I can get a legally defendable mechanism for this. And this is weird, right? One of my goals is to just keep poking at Apple and making this window get narrower. So I am why you can't have nice things. I'll just say that, all right? I want devices to be open. I don't want them to be open-ish, all right? So if there's something that Apple has managed to do where it gives them a little bit of the features that you want, just enough to make you a little bit happy on that particular day, but doesn't make them so unhappy that they shut it down, I'm just going to keep making them unhappy so they make that narrower, 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 such that I can keep the arguments I make to Library of Congress wider and wider and wider for why Apple doesn't let you do the things that you should be able to do on a truly open device, because that's my goals. I want to be able to work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, going to the Library of Congress constantly and say, we've got this strong ecosystem of people who are doing something that does not involve any direct copyright infringement. It's not copying. Somebody's not buying an app, stealing it. I want that sentence from the testimony that says the record did not demonstrate any significant relationship between jailbreaking and piracy. I want that sentence always to be there. But I also want to be able to keep doing this. And yes, he's not coming up to tell me to stop it. He's just coming up with a food. Yeah, I want that sentence to always be in the mechanism from the register, but I want to be able to argue that we should continue to have exemptions and continue to do jailbreaking, and that the exemption mechanism isn't sufficient. Thank you so much.